The big question, and you and I talked about it over dinner, behavioral finance and economics. And I'm curious if you think that's the new frontier, or is it the last advantage left in the investment world?
I think it's both. I think it's the last thing that can work, and it's the new frontier. What is behavioral finance economics? There are academic theories as to how markets should work. And those academic theories assume that humans are optimizing Bayesian updating machines, that we get new pieces of information and we are perfectly rational in how we go about using that information to update our beliefs. And those updated beliefs in aggregate cause the market price to update correctly. And I wish it were so simple. We could all do something else with our lives. Maybe I would have ended up being a rodeo cowboy and not an investment manager. But it's not that simple. And in the real world, it breaks down. But if you believe that we are not Bayesian optimizing machines, and that actual human behavior is not what academics say it is, then behavioral finance, to me, is the study of where the rubber meets the road and the gap between how academics say we should behave and how we really behave, and how that gap creates distortions or mispricing or inefficiencies or however you want to term it.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is Jeff Henriksen. He's the CEO and founder of Thorpe Abbotts Capital. He's also an associate fellow at the University of Oxford and a contributor to Forbes. Over the last 10 years, Jeff has gained knowledge and experience as a private investor with a focus on behavioral finance. Although his investment style is rooted in the teachings of traditional value-oriented thinkers, Jeff's philosophy centers on understanding the behavioral factors behind mispricing to unlock the core building blocks of the value premium. Using knowledge of these core building blocks, Jeff seeks to adapt traditional value investing philosophy to the 21st century financial markets. Jeff earned his MBA from the University of Oxford, where he received the Dean's Commendation Award. He also holds a Master's in Finance from the University of Colorado Denver and a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Colorado Boulder. Today, we start with some childhood stories and Jeff's first entrepreneurial experience. We dive deep into the concepts behind behavioral finance and economics in search of the new frontier, or maybe the last edge in the investment world. Jeff has a gift for explaining difficult concepts in a very relatable way. All investors read, many write, some publish, and others also teach on top of it. Jeff tells us what he learned teaching investing at Oxford. Jeff shares his recent memories of crisis investing while navigating through the global pandemic, and tells a story of a stock trader who lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis. A story I didn't know, but a story that gave me a new way of looking at extremely uncertain moments in time. We have a longer discussion about obliquity, a concept that's been on my mind lately. It's the idea of indirectly arriving at the goal we choose. Stay tuned to the end. One more time, my guest surprises me with a new take on the definition of success. It involves a Hollywood movie and more. Please help me welcome Jeff Henriksen. Hello, dear listener. I have a small favor to ask. If you're enjoying the show, please follow, subscribe, and most of all, share with everyone that would like it too. It's all word of mouth marketing. It's all up to your fingertips to make a small contribution and become an important part of the success of the show. Thank you. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well. Bogumil, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing very well. Jeff and I have a good mutual friend, Guy Speer. And we had a nice long dinner chat not long ago in Switzerland, and we shared a train ride through the Swiss Alps. I won't mention your ticket trouble unless you want to talk about it down the road.
Well, it wasn't my ticket trouble. It was my buddy's. Remember, I was trying to bail him out of his predicament.
You were the negotiator with the authorities.
I was unsuccessful with the Swiss train authorities. They're a tough bunch to crack, for sure.
I think we learned a thing or two. But listen, I have many questions for you, but I'd like to start from the beginning, those conversations. You're an investor. You have all kinds of ideas and thoughts, and I listen to a lot of your ideas. But I want to start from the beginning, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. And can we talk about your childhood and upbringing, your relationship with money, and maybe you can tell us more about how you got interested in investing in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, it's funny, at the ValueX event, I was speaking to a couple of people about this. And, you know, so many investors, when you ask them that question, they love to talk about how they had been interested in investing since they were like just a kid, and they bought the first stock when they were 10, and when other kids were playing baseball and, you know, chasing girls and things like that, they were home reading 10Ks. That was not me. I got into investing later in life. You know, when I was growing up, I was a very normal kid, was into sports. I grew up in Texas, a small town. I was into rodeo for a very long time. I did calf roping and team roping. And at one point when I was a kid, I wanted to be a professional rodeo cowboy. Did that all the way through high school, and didn't get involved seriously in investing. You know, went to college. I was studied history. I was going to go to law school. And I ended up getting into investing later in life, which I think actually in some ways is good. But yeah, you know, growing up, relationship with money, you know, I had my first job when I was 16. I got a driver's license. I worked on a horse farm. I did a hay hauling business with a good friend of mine 2 summers. And that was kind of my first foray into anything entrepreneurial, where we would basically, we had a pretty good little arbitrage going. We would buy hay from the county where we lived in Texas. And I think we paid something like, back then it was like $1.50 a bale. And we would load it on a trailer, take it down to Houston and sell it to horse operations for a sizable markup. And that was kind of my first entrepreneurial experience. And hay hauling in Texas in the summer also gets you really tough because it's so hot. And but yeah, no, you know, my relationship with money has always been, my family was always successful, and they, you know, I never wanted for anything. I wouldn't say I grew up as, you know, a rich kid either. But I saw that jobs I had growing up as a kid were on horse farms. They were very much manual labor, and that was great. It was a great experience. But I learned quickly that I wanted to do something more intellectual. And you know, my dad had worked in finance his whole life, and my family had had some success in the telecommunications industry. And so I saw the value of being smart, of doing great intellectual work, and, you know, that money is a way to enjoy, you know, to be free, right? If you have financial resources, you're not beholden to anybody. And to me, the biggest thing about being an entrepreneur is, with all the stress that comes with that, is that I'm my own boss. I get up in the morning, I work on things that I find intellectually fascinating and that I want to work on. And having the financial wherewithal to be able to do that, to me, should be the goal to make money. It shouldn't be to have some big fancy house or fast cars or any of that stuff. It's the freedom to live your life as you see best fit, I think, is the big takeaway that I had. And
would you call it freedom?
Yeah, I would absolutely call it freedom. I mean, I think that in one word is it.
Was there a point, a day, a moment, an encounter that made you realize you want to go into investing?
Yeah, I don't know if there's one moment. I mean, I, you know, my dad had worked in finance his whole career, was an accountant when he first started off, then was a treasurer at a real estate development company in Houston. And he, when he retired, was fortunate enough to be able to invest full time. And, you know, I watched what he did and how much he enjoyed it. And I, you know, was in my 20s at the time. And I, you know, I had, at the time, I just had a sales job, kind of not really sure where my life was going and what I wanted to do. And I would hang out with him, and I, you know, would start talking about investing. And I didn't really know a lot about it. I mean, I knew, you know, tangentially some about it from what he did. And, you know, he was a value-oriented investor and kind of just started teaching me the ropes. And I fell in love with it. I had a proclivity for it. I was good at it. I understood it. And then I went back to school and I did a master's in finance, focusing specifically on investment management. And that was a 2-year program. And then I ended up working with him, managing kind of just family capital, and then ended up going to Oxford, doing my MBA there, and then just kind of developed as an investor. My philosophy definitely changed throughout all that we can talk about. But I wouldn't say there was one moment. No, it was something that, you know, I tried a lot of things. And when you find something that comes easily, and I'm not saying that investing is easy, but the concepts behind finance, the economic and financial concepts, they always made sense to me. I enjoyed them. I really liked challenging what I was learning, trying to go my own path. And it was just something that I loved. And I was like, oh, I don't want to do anything else but this. And I don't know if there was one moment when I noticed that, but it became pretty clear pretty quickly. And that's kind of what I dedicated my life to. And I think if you're going to be an investor full time, especially managing outside capital, it has to be an obsession. It's not the kind of thing that you don't just hang up your hat at five and go home. I mean, you go home, but you never stop thinking and getting better and, you know, constantly learning. And if you don't love it and enjoy it, you probably shouldn't do it. That's one big takeaway that I had. And for me, I always loved it and I had that passion and that's what drove it.
I agree. It has to be a passion because if it's not, the guy next door or the lady next door is passionate about it and they'll spend all the time doing the work that you're probably not doing because you're not passionate about it. I think that's what really differentiates investors in the sense that they're truly committed to it or they're just curious about it, but not passionate.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Could we start with the story behind the name of your firm? There's a story there, I know.
Yeah.
Do you mind sharing it?
No, I'd love to share it. And I'll tell you in a minute why now is an apropos time to ask that question. Our firm is Thorpe Abbotts Capital. Thorpe Abbotts is a town in England, in kind of the northeastern part of England, where an airbase was located where my grandfather served in World War II. And he was a navigator on B-17s. He flew 35 combat missions over Europe and was a big influence in my life. And when I was looking to name the firm, well, after he died, my grandmother took us to England and we visited Thorpe Abbotts, which is this little small town. And we got to go see the airbase. And when I was naming the firm, I thought it would be a good homage to him. And I say that it's a good time to talk about that because Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg have a miniseries coming out, I believe the first half of this year, called Masters of the Air, which is based on a book written by a gentleman named Donald Miller that follows the 8th Air Force and the 100th Bomb Group that my grandfather was in. And that will be an excellent thing to watch. But yeah, I based it on him and his, you know, the experience that I had, you know, having him in my life. And I thought it was just a great homage to him. And I like the name too. I just think it had a really good sound to it. So it checked all the boxes.
No, I love it. I like where there's a story behind the name and then a family story tied to it. I think it creates a certain experience. I like that. I'm curious about teaching. You mentioned it. So a lot of investors read. I can't name any investor that I know that doesn't read all the time. And some of them choose to write. Many of them write for themselves. They journal. They keep a record of their thoughts, ideas. Some of them choose to write for the public. That's what I do. I like the feedback from the broader audience. Tell me where I'm wrong.
Right.
But you also decided to teach. Can you talk more about that experience and how that influenced you as an investor teaching?
Yeah. So, no, absolutely. I taught, I was at Oxford for 2 years, did my MBA, and then I taught financial modeling and valuation in the Oxford Finance Lab. In the Oxford Finance Lab, basically what it is it's bringing investment banking training inside the university. So, if you get hired by an investment bank, out of grad school or even as an undergrad, you're going to go through a training program that's going to teach basic Excel skills, three-statement financial modeling, basic valuation, DCF, comps, et cetera, LBO analysis, merger analysis, restructuring, et cetera. And so the finance lab was run by a gentleman at the time, Andreas Angelopoulos, who was a mentor to me, and he brought all of that into the university. And then so I was a student in the finance lab when I was at Oxford. And then when I graduated, he, you know, asked me if I would like to help him teach some because we really had a good rapport. And so I did that for 2 years, which was a fascinating experience. And I say that if you really want to learn something, teach it. Because it's one thing to learn it so you think that you understand it. It's another thing to learn it in a way that you have to explain it to somebody else, but you might have to explain it in multiple different ways because the way I might understand something or you might understand something is probably different than how other people understand it. So when you have to really explain it in multiple ways, I think it makes it one of those things where you learn it so well that you just, it becomes part of your blood. And if you really want to learn any of these concepts around investing, I would recommend teaching. It's a really wonderful approach to go. I learned when I did that a lot about how people think when it comes to investments, how they think when they do valuations, and how they make mistakes. That was a big takeaway for me. And I tell the story that when I was in the program, one of the things that, you know, we would have to review work that students did. And one of the things I would notice is that when students would work individually on a valuation project, or maybe we were trying to figure out the right quantum of debt to put into a company, that oftentimes their individual answers would be all over the map. But if you averaged them in aggregate, they would be really, really close to what we would think was correct. But if you let them get in groups and groupthink would take hold and you average those answers, oftentimes they were way off the map. And so I like to say when you teach a class of, say, 80 to 100 people, you have like a little miniature market. And so not only are you teaching, but you can also see how people behave and how they get things right, how they get things wrong. And in terms of our approach to investing, which is a behavioral approach, it stemmed from my experience teaching in the finance lab. And I really started to uncover how crowd wisdom works and how it fails. And if you believe that markets are efficient, you're basically assuming that crowd wisdom applies. And if you assume that you're going to go out and try to beat the market, you're implicitly assuming that it's not efficient. And if you're assuming it's not efficient, you're basically saying that crowd wisdom can fail and can become crowd madness. And so our approach has always been to find crowd madness because that's where opportunities lie. And the finance lab and teaching was really the genesis of that to me, because I really got to see in this little micro environment how it worked. So it was a, you know, to sum up, amazing experience. I highly recommend if you ever get the option to or opportunity to teach something that you love, you should do it. Because you will be you will learn more by teaching it than you ever did as a student of it.
I think a lot of investors have done it, including Buffett. I think he taught at some point early on. I had experience with interns, and I always say that I learn as much as they do. And as you mentioned, the questions they ask and the way they see things, and sometimes they see certain things for the first time. So it's still at school. They have academic understanding of things, and then I show them the real thing and the way they look at it. Is something that I might be missing. And it's really fun to see how they get passionate and curious about things. And the most fun I have is once they find an idea that they like, and then they can pitch it to me. I think it's really interesting to see. And I think it keeps my mind fresh that I'm not stuck with some assumptions. I have somebody look at it and bring a completely new opinion and view. And me explaining things, I think it's also a step up, because I have to sit down and explain it to somebody that has never done it, but is curious to learn. So,
well, and, you know, to add there, the idea of crowd wisdom works because, you know, your guess as to what a company might be worth and my guess to what a company might be worth might be radically different. Mm-hmm. But as long as our mistakes aren't correlated, right? As long as, you know, our errors, you know, everybody's guess is the right answer plus an error term. And as long as the errors aren't correlated, they cancel out. And so if you want to find mistakes, you want to find where that doesn't exist. But if you want to be a wiser investor, you should bring more diversity of thought into your process. And I think, like, when I was in England, a lot of the investment banks in Europe were hiring. They were making an effort to hire not just students out of business schools, but philosophy majors, music majors. They wanted to get diverse, you know, backgrounds into the investment bank because, I mean, I love the idea of, like, you value it, I'm going to value it. Let's get a philosophy student that's learned a little bit about valuation to value it. Let's get this music major to value it. That seems crazy, but you get the diversity of views when you aggregate them is much more likely to be correct than if you just have four business school majors, first year analysts doing it, because they typically think all the same way. And so when they get it wrong, they all get it wrong together and it's a big mistake. And then 2008 happens, right? And so I think teaching, when you get to bring in all these different views, as you mentioned, it makes you a lot better. And I love it. I can't recommend it enough, the experience.
You touched on so many things that I have in the following questions, because the big question, and you and I talked about it over dinner, behavioral finance and economics. And I'm curious if you think that's the new frontier, or is it the last advantage left in the investment world? And you can explain a little bit more what it is to those in the audience that are less familiar with it. But also, I'm just curious if it's something new, or is it really the last thing that can really work in the investment world? What are your thoughts?
I think it's both. I think it's the last thing that can work, and it's the new frontier. So I'll say it's both. And I'll explain that, or explain why I think that. Let me start. What is behavioral finance economics? I mean, there's a lot of different ways to define it, but I would say the way that we look at it is, you know, there are academic theories as to how markets should work. And those academic theories assume that humans are optimizing Bayesian updating machines, that we get new pieces of information and we are perfectly rational in how we go about using that information to update our beliefs. And those updated beliefs in aggregate cause the market price to update correctly. And if you go to your screen and look at what Amazon's trading at, it's the closest thing to intrinsic value. I wish it were so simple. We could all do something else with our lives. Maybe I would have ended up being a rodeo cowboy and not an investment manager, but it's not that simple. And in the real world, it breaks down. And you mentioned it you know, when students come in with these theories, they're taught this. Some business schools are better about teaching, I think, a more nuanced approach than others. But if you believe that we are not Bayesian optimizing machines and that actual human behavior is not what academics say it is, then behavioral finance, to me, is the study of where the rubber meets the road and the gap between how academics say we should behave and how we really behave, and how that gap creates distortions or mispricing or inefficiencies or however you want to term it. So I would say, to me, behavioral economics, behavioral finance is understanding how humans actually behave versus how we should behave and applying it in a way that helps us better understand economies and financial markets on how they actually behave. And the problem with, I mean, then the reason that we don't behave as academics say is that if you think about, and I might have these numbers slightly wrong, but yeah, I mean, humans have been walking around planet Earth for something 200,000 years or something, some big number. I think it's like a couple 100,000 years, I think, roughly speaking. If there's any anthropologists listening, I'm sure they can correct me if I'm off, but I think it's, if you Google it, I think like 200,000 years is the number. The vast majority of time that we've been running around the Earth has not been in anything considered modern, right? The modern financial markets, and I did this analysis a while back, and I might have it wrong, but if you consider the Empire State Building, like the 200,000 years, the amount of time since we've even been literate, like if you want to, well, in aggregate, we've been literate. So go back to like the Gutenberg Press, that would be like the last 4 feet of the building. Uh-huh. And if you want to talk about the amount of time that we've actually been thinking about financial markets, taking risk under conditions of uncertainty, et cetera, it's not even a foot at the top of the building. So all of our wiring, your wiring, my wiring, is based on the entire stack of the building. Mm-hmm. And we're applying it to like the last foot. Like, and that's crazy. Obviously, the way that we have evolved to survive in the wild is influencing how we behave. And the interesting thing, what behavioral economics will tell you, is that a lot of those behaviors that convey a survival benefit, when applied to making decisions of risk, you know, risky decisions under uncertainty, that it makes us make all kind of mistakes. And so behavioral economics is the study of what those mistakes are, how they cause distortions in financial market and other types of behavior.
Let me ask you this, and I've been thinking a lot about it. So we're talking about humans running the show, humans actually making decisions. Now, there are more machines participating in the market. And obviously, these days, it's a lot of the very short-term, you know, high-frequency trading that machines are doing it. A human cannot even keep up. And I'm thinking that at some point, a large chunk of activity and decision-making will be done by machines one way or the other. I mean, I know that there are algorithms reading earnings releases before a human can read it. I think there was even a joke that a release was available on the website, not to humans, but on the server, and somehow the bots already picked it up. And the stock was,
that's awesome.
You've heard about it?
No, I have not heard that. That's pretty crazy though.
Yeah, and the bots were already selling the stock. There was a few minute glitch and everybody was watching it. There was an article about it and I thought it was interesting that machines are faster than us. And of course they are. I sometimes say that I'm not smarter or faster than anybody. I'm more patient than an average person and probably an average investor. We really take a 3-5 year view. And in my mind, that's the last arbitrage. You were talking about arbitrage early on with your business. But that's the last arbitrage left. Once the machines are taking over, what is it that's left for us to do? And some of those mistakes and biases might be eliminated from the market. So the market might be perfectly efficient second to second, but may remain inefficient in a 3-5 year view. Machines are not looking far, and a lot of humans are not looking that far. What do you think about the time arbitrage as one of the ways for us to make a difference still as humans participating in this game, if you want to call it a game?
Yeah. Okay. So a couple things there. I think for time horizon, I had a professor at Oxford. He had a great statement. He said, everybody says they have a longer time horizon than everybody else. Oh. And his comment was, my definition of your time horizon is how long you can underperform before you get fired. And so I always like that. I mean, if you're just investing your own money, obviously your time horizon is different. But if you're a professional money manager, even if you're a long-term investor, I do think there are limits to how long you can underperform before capital gets taken out. But in terms of the computers, I would say this, until AI really takes over, I think most of these algorithms are still written by humans and still suffer from human bias. So I still think there's opportunities there. Now, in a world where AI is arbing all of this, I would agree with you. I think that is a a world in which it's much harder to have any edge. We're not there yet, and I don't know when we will get there, to be honest. I mean, it might be a very long time. So I think there is some period of time, probably the majority of my lifetime, I'm 44, when there's still opportunities to do what we do. I do believe that if you are still arbing the mistakes of humans, that you need to understand what other humans are relying on to try to beat you, right? And this is something we've talked a lot about recently. Mm-hmm. You know, I was always taught there are three edges in investing. There's an informational edge, so having better information than the other side of the trade. There's an analytical edge, being maybe we have the same information, but you know, one of us just analyzes it better, has a way, better way of thinking. And then there's a behavioral edge, which is historically been not letting all these behavioral biases allow you to make mistakes. The argument that we are making, and this gets me into a lot of trouble with investment managers because I'm questioning their livelihoods, but I think the informational and analytical edge is all but gone. I mean, you can still find it in certain circumstances, but if you just look at the advent of the amount of information that we can get now for free, financial information, transcripts, you talk about expert networks used to be a source of proprietary information for hedge funds. Mm-hmm. Now you can get access to these for hardly any money. So I think getting information that other people do not have, getting it legally, you know, and I'm not talking Gordon Gekko style inside information, but I'm talking getting legal proprietary information is much harder now than it was. And it's much harder now and it's only getting harder. So I think informational advantage has really eroded.
Basically, everybody knows the same things. That's
everybody knows
saying.
The same thing. I mean, go pick your favorite SaaS company and go read Tegas transcripts. Now they know a lot more than the person next door that doesn't do the work, but you're not competing against the person next door. You're competing against all the people that are setting, you know, the marginal price setters. So I think it's hard to get an informational edge. Now, analytical, here again, I mean, I can tell you, when Warren Buffett was analyzing moats back in the day, the idea of economic value added was really not well understood and it wasn't well practiced. Today, even C students in business school get these concepts. I mean, people ape Warren Buffett. They follow all these famous investors and they utilize their techniques. And so I think getting an analytical edge today is much more difficult too. And so that leads to behavioral edge, which is when I say it's the last frontier and it's the last, you know, edge and the new frontier. The problem with the behavioral edge is most people think of it in terms of defensive posturing. Like, I don't want to make these mistakes. The argument that I make is you need to use it offensively. So you should be going out there and systematically finding the mistakes of other investors. And when you find them, you should exploit them. And the other problem with the behavioral edge is most people think it only happens in rare environments, like not, you know, like buying stocks in March of 2009 or not panic selling your portfolio in March of 2020. In reality, behavioral mistakes happen every day. And our approach at Thorpe Habits has always been like, I think informational and analytical edges, they are a qualifier, not a winner. You need to understand businesses, you need to do the work, but that's table stakes at the poker game. Where you can really exploit is the behavioral edge. And to your point, I think having time horizon arbitrage is one way to do it, for sure. If you're like, look, this thing is going to really not be in a good place for the next 2 years, but in 5 years, it's going to triple, I think. You know, being able to take that type of edge, to me, that's a behavioral edge, right? You can behave in a way that I can't. Maybe I'm a short-term thinker, or maybe I've got monthly liquidity requirements at my fund, whatever it might be. And if I'm taking a shorter view than you, you can arb that. But I would say that's a behavioral arb, I would classify that under the behavioral edge. But I think there are other ways to do it too. It's not just time horizon. So that's, I just said a lot, but I mean, I think the big takeaway is I think the way a lot of people invest, this whole I do more work than you and I'm smarter than you. No, you don't. It's so many great investors. I mean, at ValueX, I had so many conversations about different
brilliant
businesses.
Brilliant people.
All brilliant. And that is who you're competing against. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't want to, if I can't consistently be smarter and get better information, then it's hard to win at that game. But if I can find behavioral mistakes, then that's a game that I know we can win at. And hardly anybody is doing this. I mean, there are a few funds that are focused on behavioral, but it's relatively a new concept. So I still think there's a lot of opportunity there.
No, I like that. You know, I think that the innovation has been on the speed side. I'm thinking of high frequency trading. A lot of that was to cut it to a millisecond so that they can execute their trades ahead of time. I think a lot of focus has been on that side. I think it's not relevant for me personally because that's not where we compete. We never hold anything for a millisecond. We hold things for years.
Right.
So that's the advantage. I was also thinking, listening to you about Warren Buffett's introduction to Ben Graham's Intelligent Investor. And I remember reading it for the first time and I was a kid and I mean, I was in my 20s and I was just discovering investing. But he wrote, everything is included in this book that you need except for the emotional discipline, right? So the vocabulary that we talk about today, behavioral economics, he was pointing out to me already, you know, 2 decades ago, there's something missing in this book. And I immediately thought, I think I'll need this, whatever that means, emotional discipline, I'll need this. And I think that's what we're talking about today. We're humans. And we will respond. We will respond to losses. We will respond to clients asking why you're underperforming. So there are all the different ways that can undermine all the informational analytical side of it and even your own behavior, because you have so much feedback from outside that will undermine your commitment to the idea, right? Mm-hmm. So in a way, we're trying to remove the human. We're trying to remove everything that can get in the way.
Right.
It's a really interesting way of looking at it. I don't know if you have thoughts about it, but
if you want to, you know, why is this position going to be a winning position?
Right.
Like it's, if you pitch me on a stock or I pitch you on a stock. The incorrect answer to me is it's an amazing business, great tailwinds, big moat, great management team. I mean,
everybody
like, that's
knows
what people
that.
Say. And it's
everybody
like,
knows
okay,
that.
Everybody knows that. Like, okay, yeah, I agree. It's a great business, great management team. They look great. I mean, like, I totally agree. Why is it mispriced? Why are there not enough marginal investors willing to hold this? Why are they wrong and why are you right? Like, I feel investing has gotten lazy because people, I hate to say it, they obsess about, I mean, I love Warren Buffett. I'm a big fan, but they obsess about just owning great businesses, great management teams, growth at a reasonable price. I mean, like when I was at business school, we'd have these people come and speak, and it's like, we only invest in the best businesses with the best management teams, with the best prospects that are misunderstood and mispriced by the market. And I'm like, okay, where are you finding those opportunities? He's like, you know, and so if somebody doesn't want to hold it because it's got an ick factor to it of some sort, then now I'm interested, or if everybody hates something, like what gets my juices flowing is when everybody agrees that something is just the worst thing ever. And maybe it is, but like, at least then, you know, okay, if I'm right on my analysis, I know why it'll work because everybody else didn't want to touch this thing. And I know that's kind of a simple concept, but I feel like it's lost. And it's lost because growth investing worked so well for so long. Just own 10 times revenue businesses that are growing and that worked from 2011, 12, all the way until, you know, fairly recently. And then it didn't work in a major way. Mm-hmm. And then you had companies, you know, funds that just really took it on the chin. And I think that to me, it's why do you own it? Why is this mispriced? Why do other people misunderstand it? And if there's not some behavioral reason to that, they misunderstand it because they're loss averse. Well, we know that humans are loss averse because loss aversion conveyed a survival benefit in the wild. And because this thing looks like the worst thing ever, they're loss averse and they don't want to hold it. And I went in and took a look and I said, you know what? It's not as bad as people say. And I can hold it for longer. I got a longer time horizon, blah, 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 blah. And that's where you really make your big money, in my view.
I agree. Another related question, you know, money in general, there's this saying, penny wise, pound foolish. You know, it's easier to understand the pennies. It's very hard to understand the pounds. And Buffett even wrote about it in the recent letter. And I wrote about millions, billions, trillions, how the numbers are impossible to comprehend by a human. What does it even mean, a $1 trillion company? If I was to cash it, does it fit in my bedroom in $100 bills? I don't know. Right?
How big a bedroom do you have, I guess?
Right. So we deal with large amounts of money and we analyze large businesses, but to really comprehend the size of it, it's really interesting. And I remember little anecdotes from books about 1920s, 1930s, when we would have runners run around with very big checks from a building to a building with no security. But then they would hold on to their pennies and don't overpay for coffee. The same people, the same traders, the same investors on Wall Street in New York in the old world when people were actually physically there.
Right.
So they were very smart about their pennies because they grew up with pennies and they felt them. They were in their pocket. They were physical. And then the checks were being moved around by some delivery boy. And I noticed it in my work, working with successful people that were very comfortable financially. And they would do in personal financial decisions of, for example, driving across the Hudson River to buy some supplies for their home for a few cents less. And they would be very proud of it. And I would think, well, given the amount of money you make and the money that this money's making for you, and I wouldn't say it, I would just think about it. it makes no sense to waste your weekend to drive across the river to buy home supplies. So I always thought, you're very smart about the pennies, but somehow you're losing what's important about the pounds. And I think it affects all of us. And I see it in my life, and I see investors do it. But that's why we take humongous risks. You've heard the stories of a few investors that lost billions with big bets in the last few years. I think we lose touch with what that money means. And Buffett wrote this story in the letter, how if you stack the $100 bills, how much is a million, how much is a billion, how tall of a stack it would be. And I think he thinks about it too, that for humans, it's very hard to process. How much money is that?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. I will say one thing. So I agree that people, you know, as these numbers get bigger, they become less meaningful. But it's how people respond. This is not quite exactly what you're saying, but it rhymes with it. Mm-hmm. What I find fascinating is how people, wealthy people especially, they love private equity. They love real estate. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes a lot of wealthy people I meet, they don't like public markets because they think they're casinos. Mm-hmm. And they think they're casinos because they turn on CNBC or Bloomberg and they see the stock market all over the place. But they look at their private equity portfolio, which is often marked internally by the private equity firm. They look at it doesn't move. And it's like, it's low vol and I get great returns. And I'm like, low vol, what do you mean? And they're like, it's low vol. My PE firm, my buyout firm, it's low vol. I don't deal with the casino markets. That PE firm's a levered portfolio. They're putting 3 or 4, maybe 5 turns of leverage on, you know, these companies. So you're talking about levered equity.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's not a public market for it, so you don't see it move as much. But if you think that when in March of 2020 came, or when, you know, last year when the market sold off, that your PE portfolio wasn't down a lot, then you're nuts. You're just completely. And so it's interesting to me. And same if you own like a building, right? Yeah. If cap rates rise, the value of your building has gone down. Now, there's not like a flashing sign in front of the building being like, oh, it's the price is moving. But it's amazing to me how people look at that and they think it's safer. And I'm like, it's not safer. But it makes sense, right? I mean, that's the behavioral thing. And so, you know, in terms of money, I would argue too that we have not, physical money, I don't know many people that carry much physical money around anymore. I mean, hardly anybody. And after COVID, like the few people that were, now it's like you get germs on it. So it's like, no, does that, I guess you could see this play out in the way a lot of retail investors invested during the pandemic, you know, these massive bets on meme stocks using options that they didn't understand. But it's what can you do? That's how people are, that they're going to do it and they're going to create opportunities. And for investors like you and me, we can go out and take advantage of them. And I know that sounds a little harsh, but like, I love it when people make mistakes. Like that's capitalism. Like if I know a group of people is making a huge mistake, then as an investor, I have a duty to my investors to go and make money off that mistake. And so, I think ultimately all of these things are good for active management. That's my capitalistic view of the situation.
You touched on something really interesting, which I would call the challenge and opportunity of a daily quote, which happens in the public market, that minute to minute you can know. And if all your money is in the public market, you can really know your net worth go up and down between lunch and after lunch. And if a substantial part of your net worth is in the market, over lunch, you might be up and down by a substantial amount of money, right? A couple of years worth of savings, if it's an inheritance or if it's a sale of a business that started it. And what I noticed is a lot of people have real difficulty with it. And some people that want to invest on their own, coming from the VC world, they sold the business, they want to try the public markets. And I've seen case by case many stories where people just fail to accept the movement in the price. It's just something they can't deal with. And it creates an opportunity for you and I, but for some people, it's something that they don't have the emotional discipline to tolerate. They've never seen it before. They don't know how to interact with it. And it leads them to some mistakes, or it makes them just leave that market altogether. But it leaves it to us. I think with the public market, the opportunities that arise, and I think that's what people underestimate thinking about private equity and real estate, the opportunities that can appear in the public market can hardly appear in the private market because there's no daily quote. Even if there's a pressure to sell, the time to execute the sell of a building or of a private equity stake, it's not going to be minutes. It's going to be a much longer process.
Right.
And to find somebody who is a distressed seller and a big shareholder in a privately held business, you probably don't want to be the other side of it buying. There might be a serious issue. Now, the distress in the public market can have often nothing to do with the fundamentals, but all with the behavior and the emotions that you mentioned, which is really where the opportunity lies. But I think people don't appreciate it enough that public equity markets can create, or public markets in general can create opportunities that you can't possibly find anywhere else just because of the, yeah. The
100% agree. And Bogomil, yeah. I would add that I don't think this is something that can be taught. I mean, I agree with Buffett when he says, to be a good investor, it's not a game of who has the highest IQ. I mean, you have to obviously be intelligent, but the smartest guy in the world might be, didn't Newton or somebody lose all their money in the South Sea bubble? I might have that wrong, but very smart people make very bad investment decisions because there is an emotional component that really trumps all. And one thing, the first lesson I got in investing, very first lesson from my dad, he says, look, it's not always going to be the case that this is true, but more often than not, this is a good rule of thumb. I'm like, great, Dad, what's that? He goes, when making an investment decision, if it hurts like hell, it probably is the right decision. If it feels really good, it's probably the wrong decision. And that always stuck with me. I mean, so it's like, for me, I always like that. It's a personality thing. I've always prided myself on being able to put myself in emotionally challenging situations, knowing that the other person can't do it. And this went all the way back to the high school. You know, I was never a really big kid or strong kid, but when it came to getting in some kind of argument where I had to take a stand that was like not going to be popular and people were going to, I was like, I'll do it. This is fun because I knew nobody else would. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the type of quality that makes a good investor. You need to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And the more that you get comfortable with being uncomfortable, the more power that you realize that conveys. And then all of a sudden it doesn't become uncomfortable anymore. It becomes kind of how you behave. And I think that is just something that, and I don't know if it's genetic or if it's experience or what, but I honestly think that cannot be taught. I think everything else can be taught. Mm-hmm. You can learn how to analyze. I mean, valuing businesses is not rocket science. You know, it's basically, I don't know, eighth grade math, right? I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. But like emotionally being able to buy when others are selling and to take a position that is contrary to what a lot of people think. And then, because you're never going to bottom ticket, you're going to take the position and then you're going to see your portfolio go down. And that sucks. And to be comfortable with all of that, I think it's something you either have the chops to do or you don't. I do not think it can be taught. This is coming from teaching. And that's one thing that there were students that either I was like, these students make great investors, or they understand everything really well, but they'll be terrible investors. They just don't have the mentality. So I think that's my take anyway.
So I think there are many sides to it. One, you say, you know, comfort, discomfort, but I'm also thinking about delayed gratification, which really pays off in investing. Do you think it's a gene or it's something that can be developed?
The idea of delayed gratification.
Yeah.
Well, there's the marshmallow thing, right? The study that, the kids grab the marshmallows. I think that's probably genetic.
You think so?
I think everybody, you know, everybody, I mean, if you have a bad day and you end the day by like going to your favorite place and getting a hamburger and a beer, right? That's a bit, you know, it's not healthy, but like, you're like, well, that makes me feel good. So I think everybody has a little bit of that in them.
Of course. We're human.
But you know, we're human, right? Yeah. But some people really can be, you know, like, look, this is going to suck for 2 years, but at the end of it, we're very confident that this is the right decision. And, you know, I heard a quote from Michael Burry, I think he did a graduation speech at maybe it was UCLA. And he said, how did he phrase it? He said, you know, there are people that take long-term risks for short-term gains. Or there are situations, rather, where you're taking, you know, really long-term risk for short-term gains. Mm-hmm. But then there are situations where you're taking short-term risks for long-term gains. Uh-huh. And it's in that second situation, the short-term risk for long-term gains, when you find that in life, you want to hit that button over and over and over again. And that, I think, is just such a nice way to phrase it. Lots of times when you buy something that you know is mispriced, you know is undervalued, or you buy in our case, we can get more into, I know you had a question on risk, but we tend to be more diversified than a lot of funds. But if I'm making an investment across the number of securities, I might know in the next 6 months, this is going to be pretty damn volatile. And maybe I can, and we hedge. I mean, so, you know, we can short and we can hedge some of that out, but ultimately you need to look at it and say, you know, but I know that in the next 2 to 3 years, the gains that we will see are well worth it. And your ability to go into those situations, I think, really determines whether or not you're a good investor or not.
Before I ask you about risk, which is a topic I love, and I'm curious about your thoughts, and I kind of know where you're going to go with it. But I want to ask you about your article about Warren Buffett in Forbes. and your thoughts about that. And you know, we're all value investors, but are we? And tell me more.
Yeah. So I wrote an article a couple years ago, and it was called Don't Be a Warren Buffett Cover Band. I wrote that article because, you know, I go to Omaha every year and I walk around and I love going to Omaha. And Warren Buffett, I mean, amazing influence. I mean, reading the Berkshire letters are a gold mine. And I think Buffett and Munger are people you should idolize. Full stop. That said, you should not be a Warren Buffett cover band. And I see these people that just go around and they just ape everything Warren Buffett says. You see it a lot in the circles we run in. I just think, I'm like, if Warren Buffett were our age today, would he be? He didn't ape Ben Graham, did he? Ben Graham was his idol. And Warren Buffett learned a lot from Ben Graham. But then Buffett took what Graham did and he adapted it to his own style and made his own way of investing. And so I see when I see all these people, you know, running around, I look for great businesses, great management teams, a big wide economic moats. And then you look at what they own and they own a lot of what Buffett owns. And they, you know, it's just like, really? I mean, in the article, I talk about understanding what really constitutes the reasons Buffett was successful, the underpinnings of why a value-oriented philosophy works. Mm-hmm. Take that away, but then adapt it to your own style. Adapt it to unique things that you see or maybe some unique approach. You know, for us, it's really understanding the behavioral element. But when I see people that just copy almost verbatim what he does, I feel like they think that they're being intellectual. And I'm like, actually, you're just basically copying somebody. And then the investors will talk about, oh, you should copy. If it works, copy it. And I'm like, well, I don't think it's going to work. If everybody, I mean, just logically, think about this. And tell me if I'm wrong logically, because maybe I am. And maybe in the comments on this, maybe people will disagree. But if there's a guy that was the best investor of all time, and he's done nothing but talk about what made him the best investor of all time, and then millions of people follow his advice, is it crazy to think that maybe in the next 50 years, that approach won't work as well?
Yeah.
I mean, great example, poker. Doyle Brunson wrote Super System, which was his book on poker back in the 70s. And in that style of playing poker, if you go play No Limit Texas Hold'em and you use a lot of that technique, it doesn't work anymore because everybody learned it and the game evolved. And I don't see why investing would be any different. And so I think, yes, learn from Buffett, but the idea that you just ape him mindlessly, which so many people do, I just take issue with that. I think that's unoriginal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, at the very least, if you don't ape Warren Buffett, you know, you won't be unoriginal.
I like the idea that investing has evolved. We as investors evolve throughout our lifetime. And Warren Buffett has been doing it for I don't know, 70 years or 80 years. But I'm also thinking, you know, we watch those stories of chefs, somebody that wants to become a chef, and they all go to France to become a French chef. And then they realize, I really like what I grew up with. And they're from Sweden or from South America. And then they travel back home. And then they deploy the techniques and the thinking that they learned to their own cuisine. They find their own local ingredients. And I always find it fascinating because it kind of reminds me of investing. So we all go to Omaha. We hear about the original wisdom of value investing that dates back to Benjamin Graham and really even, I think, before. And then we make it our own, something that resonates with us. And the stocks you pick and I pick might be completely different, although we share some of the principles and some of the ideas. And I think that's where the beauty happens here, that make it your own. And I like the idea that I discussed with Gautam Bate, who wrote Joys of Compounding. I don't know if you know the book or if you know him.
I've not read it. I'm familiar with the book. I mean, I've heard of it.
And we talked about the idea of cloning ideas, which is making what you were talking about, aping, cloning ideas. And I always had an issue with that. And we had an interesting discussion. And the essence of the discussion was that you can copy the idea, but you can't copy the conviction behind it, whether it's you're copying Buffett
No, I love that line. That's true.
Like, let's pause and think about it. And I thought, you can't copy the conviction behind the idea. I can look up anybody's filings that's a meaningful investor and has public filings, right? I can look up what they just bought, what they have, but I will never develop the conviction that they have behind those ideas. And I think that really gave me the vocabulary to explain something that I had an issue with before, just copying other people. Because unless you copy them step by step, everything what they do, you're going to make huge mistakes. They will bail out of some ideas. Yep. They will make some ideas bigger that you didn't make them bigger. I mean, your returns will be completely different. Cloning or aping, I think it's a dangerous territory unless, I mean, in that case, just buy Berkshire Hathaway shares, right?
Right. It might as well. I mean, at least then. You're at least getting their buy and sells in real time with that. Although you're getting embedded tax liabilities from Coke, but whatever.
So if you want a copy, maybe just buy the shares of whoever you admire. But anyways, let's go back to risk. I feel like risk is such a misunderstood concept. And I know that you're not a believer in beta or value at risk, any single number measures. What risk means to you and how do you operate knowing that it's out there?
Yeah, if you want to have a investment manager go off on a tangent, ask he or she what they think of risk, because that'll do it. Okay, so at a high level, beta and asset covariance with the overall market, volatility in general. I've understood now that I manage outside money, I do understand this idea that, look, if your fund's super volatile, even if it doesn't matter in the long run, the chances of investors redeeming in a market environment where you should be putting capital to work goes up. So I do think there's some element, I've kind of evolved a bit where I'm like, look, I used to, when I first started, I just said, beta's for idiots. You know, I don't know if it necessarily is true. But that said, the major risk we think about is permanent capital impairment, which is probably, now I'm aping Warren Buffett, but this is one area where I think we can agree that this is one of those timeless principles. And so to me, you know, that is, how do I define that? I mean, pretty simply, if I'm going to invest in some asset, what's the probability that I'm wrong? And if I am wrong, how much do I lose? That, I mean, I think that's pretty much it. Obviously, when you think about risk management, we think about convexity. Mm-hmm. So convexity, you know, if I'm right, how much do I make? If I'm wrong, how much do I lose? And I want situations where I'm making much, much, much more than if I'm wrong, what I'm losing. So having highly convex situations and then being right more often than you're wrong. I mean, that's how you make great portfolio returns. So you want to have a high hit rate. That hit rate doesn't need to be 80%, you know, but it needs to be. And look, you can actually have a hit rate below 50% if the convexity is strong enough, right? I mean, there are ways to balance this, but we want to be right, you know, call it ideally 2/3 of the time. And we want to be highly convex. And thinking in those terms, I think, is a really interesting way to think about risk. And look, hedging is an area where I've also really evolved on. We do not believe in single stock shorting, although we do short. We short indices to hedge out certain risks, but I do not believe in taking meaningful shorts on single names. And that's after GameStop. That's after what happened with Melvin Capital. I mean, I think that has not gone away, and there's a real risk to shorting individual names that you can really permanently impair a portfolio if you have a 2 or 3% position that for some reason 10x is on you. You're in big trouble. And so I think, you know, for us, we want to own. And the other thing, and I'll this is my thing with risk. I'll just keep going, right? I'm like, as my mom would say, diarrhea of the mouth. You just keep going. The other thing that I disagree with a lot of kind of value investors is the idea on concentration. And here again, I'm going to get myself in trouble, but I used to be the punch card investing, you know, diversification is laziness, blah, 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 blah. The problem though, is that if you follow my logic on informational and analytical edges eroding, the reason they've eroded is that the distribution of skill among investors has narrowed dramatically. And if you read Michael Malbazin on his book on luck and skill, what you'll learn is that as a distribution of skill in anything, baseball is a great example, as it narrows, luck mathematically plays a larger role. It has to. And if you believe the distribution of skill has narrowed in investing, that means luck is now playing a larger role, whether we like it or not. And if luck is playing a larger role than it was 30 years ago, taking a concept like Buffett's punch card investing and applying it just today doesn't make a lot of sense, because look, you might have a 5-stock portfolio, but there's a lot of random things that can happen that are just beyond your control. You can do all the work in the world and get blindsided by something and risk permanent capital impairment. So our philosophy has evolved to owning a much larger portfolio of more equal weight positions. So I think that's one way to manage it. And we want to own a larger portfolio of equal weight positions that exhibit significant convexity and that have a high hit rate. And then when we think the market environment justifies it, we want to hedge. And when we're going to hedge using index shorts that best hedge our portfolio. So we're going to remove the risk of getting memed. And I that's kind of our view on risk. I mean, it's a fairly simple approach, but that's evolved just through my experience as an investor, which professionally I've been investing since 2007. So I've got pretty good amount of time under my belt, and that has fallen out of basically the experiences that I've had. And yeah, we're pretty at our firm. We're adamant about this.
I agree with you. And the way we look at it, volatility is not risk. If anything, it's an opportunity.
Yeah, totally.
Some people consider underperformance as a risk, and because they're lagging the market, to me, it has nothing to do with what we're doing. And at the end of the day, the permanent loss of capital, that's the real risk. You put in the money, you can't get it back. And what you're getting is just a portion of what you put in.
I would argue that's, one caveat to that, though, is that the thing with volatility is that if you have great LPs that all agree with you, then yes. But if you have an LP that when they experience the volatility, they redeem, and then they redeem and they force you to sell before you get true value to be reflected, then the volatility, kind of by hook or by crook, got you. Even though that's not like what you'd like to do. So I do think, and this is why I believe in index shorting, that there are environments where it's just like, look, it makes a lot of sense to hedge here. And we internally, when we say, well, how do you define those environments? Well, we look at essentially the amount of behavioral dislocations in the market. And when you don't see many, that means there's a lot of complacency. And in a complacent environment, it is worth it to give up some upside to put on a hedge, in our view. Mm-hmm. That would be my only caveat to that, is that I do worry about, because I fundamentally agree, if every LP thought like you and me, that's 100% right. The problem is that they don't. The volatility gets them, and that's where it can get you, unfortunately.
Yeah, I would call it a business risk, right?
So it's a business risk.
It's a business risk. So if you see it as a separate bucket for a minute, right, the investment risk, and then the business risk, meaning the assets will go away. And I think Jean-Marie Veillard, who is a famous value investor, he said he would rather lose half of his clients than half of his clients' money. And I think it's very telling, and he was in a position to accept that as a business risk. But of course, if you're managing other people's money, volatility will get to them, and in some cases, underperformance will get to them.
And I'm not saying that makes it right to worry about volatility. What I am saying is that when people are like, volatility is not risk, it's like, clearly you've not managed outside money. So it's like, it's something that you do need to keep in the back of your mind, I think.
It's definitely a business risk, that's for sure. I was going to ask you about the last 3 years, pandemic investing.
Yep.
3 years, and some people say, and I would agree that we lived, three or four decades in the last 3 years with, rates going from zero to high, from market going up to collapsing to recovering, and businesses went through, some of them, their volumes went down 80%, they fully recovered, they doubled, they hired, now they're firing. I'm curious what you've learned throughout those 3 years, because they're very different than any of the almost coming up on two decades of my own experience. I've learned a lot in the last 3 years, probably more than in the previous, 15, 17. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so we launched our firm in November of 2019. So, that was an interesting time to launch. We had a pandemic, and now the worst inflation since going back to the 70s. Lessons learned, and there are a lot. Okay. I would say that this first one I'm going to talk about is a confirmation of a lesson that I really learned in the financial crisis. But I put the theory to work, and I got confirmation in 2020. And that is this, and this is going to seem like a little more philosophical, but what really gave us an edge in 2020, and we, 2020 has been the best year that our firm has had. It's been the best year that I've ever personally had as an investor. So I think we did a really good job in 2020. And now people will be like, well, in hindsight, the vaccines and the market. And I'm like, well, you really, to make the most money, you had to be allocating in March and April. And it was not easy to do. And when we were doing it, pretty much everybody disagreed with us. And some people will say, oh, well, you just got lucky. And it's like, no, this was pretty clear to me. What I learned in 2008 is that when the world seems like it's ending, the powers that be, and when I say the powers that be, I'm talking about humanity. I'm talking about the Fed. I'm talking about fiscal authorities. I'm talking about scientists. I'm talking about whoever needs to muster the resolve to solve the problem will do whatever it takes to solve the problem. In 2008, the right thing to realize was that, the financial authorities, monetary and fiscal, will do whatever it takes to prevent disaster from happening. And you don't want to bet against that. All these bears that came out, and look, they make brilliant arguments. I mean, listen to Jeremy Grantham. He's a smart guy. But are these ideas really actionable? I mean, I don't see and maybe I'm wrong, but somebody show me a really big bear that has an amazing track record. I don't know if they exist. And the reason is that it's in nobody's interest to let the world fall apart. And so the pandemic hits. Our views were, okay, clearly, one, monetary authorities are doing everything and then some. Jay Powell took Ben Bernanke's playbook, dusted it off, and added a whole big bunch of cool stuff to it. All right, so monetary was checkbox. One of the most divided Congresses ever in the United States, with one of the most, probably of all time, I hope, crazy presidents that nobody got along. They all got together. They did Operation Warp Speed, which, say what you will about Donald Trump, but that worked. They, fiscal authorities, got together and approved all kinds of stimulus to save the economy. I mean, everybody came together and it all happened quickly. Mm-hmm. And when I saw this, I was like, dude, if you're betting against this, either through shorting or just holding cash, then you really did not learn the lessons of 2008 and 2009. And so that was that's one big lesson. And people were like, well, it'll take 5 years to get a vaccine. It's like, with all the brilliant minds in the world all trying to solve this, I'm willing to take a bet that they figure it out. And that being, when everybody is panicking and there's a massive motivation for humanity, the authorities, fiscal, monetary, whoever, to get together and solve the problem, you probably want to be betting on success, not failure. That's just a general view that I had. The other thing is, when I heard all of this talk of, well, companies are going to survive, but the equity claim won't. That was the other big thing we heard, right? That basically all the creditors are basically going to become the new equity holders for companies in the U.S. because revenues are going to zero. We're going to set the economy on the side of the train tracks, as Buffett said. I just started thinking about, well, if that happens, what does that mean for pension funds holding all these stocks? What does this mean for investors holding? I mean, like, what does that really mean? That means that everybody that holds equity is going to get taken out to the woodshed. Mm-hmm. Are the powers that be going to let that happen? I mean, I know this is a really simple way to think about it, but just ask yourself, is there any world in which the powers that be are going to let that happen? And the answer is no. There's no world that's ever going to happen in. And sometimes just a very simple view is the correct one. And I remember even in the ValueX community, I mean, like, everybody's going back and forth, like, oh my God, this is going to happen. This is going to happen. I mean, people are sending pictures of meteorites heading towards planet Earth. And the entire time I'm sitting there thinking, man, this is great. This is, people really are freaked out by this. And we had a couple data points, right? If you looked at the numbers from that cruise ship, we had a little test. If like half of the cruise ship had died, I probably wouldn't have been getting long equities. But you could just look at the cruise ship and you realize that only a very few number of people died. Like, so if you extrapolated that out, which is dangerous, what you would realize is that, yeah, this is going to kill a lot of people and this is terrible, but it's not the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, we just took a view that was very contrary to other people. The values that we were finding were so insane. I never thought we would see market movements outside of 2008 and 9 ever again in my lifetime. And we got to see them. But we didn't want to make any big bets because we might get any one company wrong. Right. So what we did, and the way we continue to invest, is we made a lot of little bitty bets on, because we have an algorithmic approach to finding behavioral dislocations, on what fell out of this environment. And what fell out of this environment was, you could easily own 80 to 100 equal weight positions and make an absolute killing in the market. And it's very rare when you can have those kind of returns across that kind of large number of companies. And so that was my big lesson, is to take advantage of the market environment you're given. And, you know, I heard there's a great story, but you ever hear the story about the guy? I don't know if it's true or if it's like just one of these urban legends, but it's a good story. There was a guy that apparently was a trader during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which it was the Friday the stock market tanked, and like it was right in the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And some trader, you know, went home that day levered long, and he's sitting there having a beer with his friends on the weekend, probably hoping that they don't, you know, blow up in a nuclear holocaust. Right. And they said, why on earth would you be levered long right now? And he says, well, two things are going to happen on Monday. One of two things. One, nuclear war. In which case, what does money even matter? Like, if we have nuclear war, this is pointless. Like, who cares? If I'm rich, broke, doesn't matter. Probably all dead. Or they solve it and the stock market rips. So either I should go into this levered long. I mean, there's no reason why you shouldn't go into it levered long, right? Like, you should. That's one of the few times in life, actually, putting leverage on an equity portfolio in aggregate probably made complete logical sense. Now, think behaviorally how difficult that was to do. Mm-hmm. Very difficult. I mean, probably impossible for 95% of investors, but logically, it is 100% the right move. Mm-hmm. Now, COVID wasn't nuclear war, but there were elements of that. Like, if the economy was going to be destroyed to the point where all these equity claims just got completely woodshedded, pension funds are, you know, we had a joke in the office. It's like, you're either buying gold and guns or you're buying stocks. And that I think there are certain instances where that's true. And history will show that if you're the one that is buying stocks and there's all these reasons that authorities have not to let the world end, that you will make a lot of money. And that's when, I mean, wealth is transferred. I had a friend of mine, ValueX friend, who said this once, and I really love the quote. He said, it's environments like that where wealth is transferred from the weak hands to the strong hands. And I think being emotionally strong and being able to see through all of that, that is where long-term wealth is really created. So that was the major lesson I learned. Now we can get into other stuff too, but that's the one I'm most passionate about. And it's the one, by the way, I get the most pushback on too.
Not for me.
Yeah. I mean, my view is if you don't agree with, you know, that way of thinking, then we want to be partners with people that think like us, not people that don't think like us. But I mean, I want to be upfront about how we view tumultuous situations like that. And that's how we view them.
We were buying in March of 2020. I knew
that's why we got along so well with that dinner. I was like, this Bogomil was a buyer in March of 2020. I can feel it in my bones.
I mean, I don't want to feel bad about it, but I was excited in the sense that stocks were coming to me instead of me chasing them. And it was such a refreshing experience because for so many years, we would look at something and then it was up 20% before we could pull the trigger, even if we were quick. And this was the time when I thought, oh, it's really coming my way. And I'm looking at stocks that are at 5, 10, 20-year lows.
I know. It was insane.
And it was incredible because 3 years of gains disappeared in a week or two, maybe 3 weeks, I don't know. But it was an incredible correction and an emotional game. And I was just looking at the quality and I was happy to pay this kind of price. And we were happy to accept, you know, a 3-5 year horizon if it really takes that long for us to leave our homes, go outside again and live our lives. But 3-5 years, I thought, I can wait.
I did a Bloomberg radio interview and and the guy that did the interview, I think he was just asking this rhetorically. I don't think he believed it, but he asked me rhetorically. We were talking about, and I was making a very similar argument that there's all these opportunities and I mentioned a couple of restaurant stocks that I thought were interesting. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I mentioned like restaurant stocks in general. And he was like, well, Jeff, I mean, even if these companies survive, isn't there an argument to be made that are people ever going to want to go out to a restaurant again after this experience? And like that question to me was, I was just what? Like, yes, of course they will. Like, it was so obvious. Like, you know, people are going to, the idea that we were never going to go to restaurants. I mean, that's what I was being told by the person on the other side of the trade selling these stocks basically said, well, even if their balance sheet is healthy enough to survive, restaurant meals are a thing of the past. Man, if that's the thinking, I am willing to take the other side of that bet.
That's the biggest weakness of our thinking as humans, that we extrapolate.
Big bias.
Yep. We extrapolate the good and then we extrapolate the bad.
Near-term emotional events, we over-extrapolate them too far into the future.
And this creates opportunities for those that actually are willing to pay attention. And it can get us in trouble when we've seen in 2021 growth stocks go up to ridiculous valuations because people thought, oh, they can really grow at 50% forever. Which they won't.
They won't.
They haven't.
Nope.
And then when bad things happen, we assume, I think I will never leave my home again.
Yeah. It's like, And that was just so ridiculous on the face of it. I was just like, people really believe that? Like, it was crazy.
Yeah.
But people did. And that's why you could pay, I think, when we bought Ruth Chris, I mean, we were paying, I don't know, like 2 or 3 times earnings, normalized earnings. And I was like, dude, I mean, if that ends up being, and then look, we didn't pick a big position in it. I mean, it wasn't like I had 10% of my fund in that. I mean, but we did a lot of little bitty bets like that. And not, you know, every one of them might not work out. But in aggregate, if you bet on enough horses that are 5-to-1 dogs and the odds are paying 10-to-1 or 20-to-1, you might not win each and every bet. But in aggregate, those bets are going to make a lot of money because, you know, you're playing the odds correctly. And to me, that's investing in a nutshell. You know, so many investors want to find the next Amazon. They want to find the next Secretariat at the track.
Mm-hmm.
Best people at the track are the ones that find the 5-to-1 dog horse that's being, the odds are implying 10-to-1.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to me is, that's investing at its finest.
Mispriced opportunity. I want to ask you the very last question. And I'm always curious to hear about success. What's your own definition of success? How do you know you're on track? And if you're headed somewhere, if it's a destination, how will you know you made it?
Wow. You know, and this I know you, I don't like to think about questions ahead of time because I like to be spontaneous. And this
let's
is
see,
one
let's
that
I
see
I'm where not, it goes.
It's a good, yeah, so we'll see where it goes. I mean, I think at its core, success is setting a goal and achieving it. I think some of the problems, though, is you might have a really big goal, right? I don't know. If you're a politician or you want to be a politician, your goal is to be president.
Yeah.
You know, you can't define success as whether or not you're, if I'm not president yet, I'm not successful. You know, maybe you have all these intermediate goals. You know, maybe it's to start off by running for town council. Mm-hmm. And maybe getting on the ballot for your town council is not the always the easiest thing. That would be some success, right? It's a step in the right direction. So I've always thought of, you know, intermediate goals and long-term goals. What are the intermediate things I need to do to get to my long-term goals? And I want to see progress on the intermediate path with, you know, with, if my goal is to have some target AUM or be considered one of the top investors in the country or something like that, that's a really big long-term goal. Maybe my near-term goals need to be, you know, did I in the last several months, did I make more correct decisions than incorrect decisions? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I'm having success. I'm on track. So I think we should all, you know, I took a golf lesson once when I was a kid, and I'll never forget the guy, I think his name was, what was it? He's out of Austin. This guy named Bill Moretti, I think his name was. And he said, look, you want to know the secret to golf? I said, of course. Yes, who doesn't, right? He said, the secret to golf is to focus on execution and not results. And I'm like, well, that seems really simple. And he's like, look, no, think about putting a good swing on the ball. Think about following through, whatever it is. Do not care where the damn ball goes. If you start caring about where the ball goes, you will inevitably do something to make it screw up. Just execution, not results. And that not only helped in golf, it helped in life. And I think for me, success is executing. And if I can have a day where I say I executed well, to me, that's success. And as long as it's on the path that I want it to be on, those little bitty successes are getting me to my ultimate goal. I think that is not only, it's a healthier way to live. And while we're at it, can I throw a little life lesson that I've gotten?
Tell me, yes.
All right. So one of my favorite movies growing up was the miniseries based on Larry McMurtry's book, Lonesome Dove. And if you haven't seen Lonesome Dove, it's a great classic American Western tale, and it stars Tommy Lee Jones and Danny Glover and, oh gosh, David Duvall. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, sorry, Robert Duvall. David Duvall's the golfer. Robert Duvall. And there's a scene in there where Gus is played by Robert Duvall, who's a really cool character, and he's talking to a woman named Lorena, who is on the cattle drive, and her only goal in life was to go to San Francisco. And she's talking about how depressed she is because she doesn't think she'll ever get to San Francisco. That's like her goal. That's what she wants. And she's all bummed out. And Gus tells her, he goes, you know, the secret to life that I've learned, he says, look, the problem is if you make your life all about one big thing, whatever that thing is, it's most likely to turn out to be a disappointment. So he says, this only healthy way to live as I can see it is to learn to enjoy all the little everyday things. And he said, like, you know, a soft bed at night, you know, a sip of whiskey, looking at the sunset, you know, the way a great buttermilk biscuit tastes, you know, little things. He's like, that's the way you should live. And I think I've tried to live my life that way, but I've also put it into my theory of success. If you're not going to feel successful unless you achieve whatever the big thing you want is, I'm going to tell you, most likely you're not going to achieve it. Like, everybody has big dream goals, right? If you're a baseball player growing up and you want to be in the major leagues, odds are you're not going to get in the major leagues. Maybe you will, but odds are it's a small probability. So if your definition of happiness and success is getting to the majors, well, you're really setting yourself up there for disappointment. And that's kind of stupid if you think about it. Like, you should have those goals. And so to me, the little everyday things in a success sense can be all the little everyday goals. And if you take joy in hitting those goals, then life is just a lot more fun. And by the way, you'll be happier. And if you're happier, you will inadvertently have a stronger probability of reaching the big goal because you're not putting as much pressure on yourself. So that's kind of my philosophy.
I love it. I love it.
So that was off the cuff, but
I think this was great.
I think I got it.
I think it was great. Have you heard of the term obliquity? Obliquity. It's the idea of achieving goals in an indirect way. And let me explain.
I've not, no. I wish I could say yes because it sounds really cool, but I'm going to be honest. I've not heard of this, but I like it.
So I was just introduced to it, or at least I got the vocabulary to explain what I observed before. And when I tell you what it is, I think you'll say, oh, I see it every time or a lot of times in my life. But we all want to be happy, but happiness is not something you can achieve directly. You're doing other things that you enjoy. You might be playing music or painting or reading a book, and happiness sneaks up on you. It's the side effect of sorts of your other pursuits. Now, in the business world, the studies show that companies that obsess about profit, they will push the pricing too high, they'll push the costs too low, and they will actually undermine the ultimate success that they have. But now, if they focus on the customer experience, if they provide good service, if they take care of the customer, if they take care of all those qualitative parts of the business, the profit will follow because the volume will go up, people will accept higher pricing, and so on. So that company might actually, in an oblique way, reach higher profit than the one that's obsessed about profit. And I think once you think about it, you start to see those things in life over and over again. In investing, if you say, I want to have the best return possible, I want to outperform the market by the highest margin possible, you might actually not get there as much as somebody else that fell in love with the practice, because that's what I'm hearing when you talk about it. You're enjoying the journey, chopping wood, carrying water, the proverbial
right
process. And the outcome might be, look, the returns are really, really good, but not because you obsessed about that as the ultimate goal.
That 100% aligns with what I believe. I mean, if you take it to returns, if you're like, look, I need to, the S&P is going to be up 10% this year. I need to be up 30. Let's go find ways to get 30% returns. Okay, inevitably, you're probably going to make some really big mistakes.
Yeah.
What you should be like is like, look, and everybody's style of investing is different. For us, it's like, we love systematic behavioral error. Mm-hmm. And we want to go out and find systematic behavioral error. That's what we do. So let's go do it. Mm-hmm. And let's do that. Let's focus on that execution, not results. If you get result oriented, inevitably you'll act too aggressively. I mean, I think that's the real risk, right? You get too mm-hmm. aggressive.
Yeah.
I love that term obliquity. Am I saying that
obliquity,
right?
Obliquity. Yeah. There's a book about it, and I'll send you a few things and I'll add in the notes. But once I heard it, I thought it happens over and over again in life and in business. I just didn't know the term. I didn't know how to describe it. But now that I have the word, I know that it's all over the place when you think about it, obliquity.
No, I mean, I think it absolutely makes sense. And I think that if you want to be successful in what you're doing, having that philosophy will go a long way to help you in those pursuits.
Yeah, focus on the practice. Jeff, this was amazing. Thank you so much. Thank you for being so generous with your time. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah, no, yeah. I'm sorry, by the way, I have my head cold. I apologize to you in the audience. But you hear me sniffling too much. It's the pollen in the air here in Virginia, but this has been great.
Yeah, you got your radio voice, I told you. You already have a radio voice, but now you stepped it up.
Stepped up the radio voice with the head cold. It's in high gear.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Great. Bogomil, thank you, and look forward to seeing you again soon.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seacard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seacard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.